Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
You want to be nasty? Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiya yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país, tá? Nada, absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome to PALcast, a podcast by the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an effort to understand how law can be used to further, as well as to resist, autocratic forces that have been on the rise around the globe. You can learn more about the project at autocratic-legalism.net. PALcast is sponsored by the OU Center for Brazil Studies. Research and sound production for this episode were provided by Ahmed Abdelaziz. My guest today is Anthony Pereira. Pereira has a PhD in government from Harvard University and is now a professor of Brazilian studies at the King's College in London, where, until recently, he also served as the director in the King's Brazil Institute. Pereira is the author of Political Injustice, Authoritarianism and the Rule of Law in Brazil, Chile, and Argentina, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press in 2005, which, for reasons that I try to explain and explore in my conversation with him, is a book that many of us at the PAL Project have found useful to understand the relationship between law, democracy, and democratic backsliding. As always, in this season of the podcast, I try to mostly focus on conceptual and theoretical matters. But having a Brazil expert on the show, I feel tempted to sidetrack and touch on issues of more direct and contemporary relevance to that country, my country, and what each of us can do to support democracy and the rule of law there. Here's the interview. Anthony Pereira, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I wanted to start this with a very basic question about your book, Political Injustice. What did you study there and what did you conclude?
Thanks, Fabio. So I think the mystery at the heart of my book is this question of why a political regime that came about through force, through a coup or through an insurrection, why would it care about the law? Because its very constitution, its very foundation is an extrajudicial act of some kind. And if authoritarian regimes do use the law, how can we explain the different ways that they use it? And this question, which sounds very abstract, came from my reading of how the dictatorships in Argentina and Chile and Brazil in the 60s and 70s, how they used or didn't use the law to deal with opponents and dissidents. And what I noticed was that in the Brazilian case from 64 to 85, there was a lot of what I called judicialization of repression. In other words, a lot of people who were detained ended up getting prosecuted in military courts. And if you take a crude measure, if you just say how many victims of repression were killed or disappeared without any kind of judicial procedure, and how many were actually tried in some way. In Brazil, Brazil is sort of one end of the spectrum. You have a lot of people who are tried, who were dealt with in courts, even if at the beginning they might have been tortured and they might have been kind of off the books, not registered as detainees. Argentina was at the other end of the spectrum. The regime that started in 1976 that engaged in what was called the Dirty War. Most of the repression was completely extrajudicial. They didn't really bother to try anyone. And Chile was sort of in the middle. It was a mix. And its military justice system was more insulated from the civilian. So the question moved from the abstract to the concrete with those cases. And the question became then, why do dictatorships engage in what I call authoritarian legalism. And you could also call this rule by law. You know, Ginsburg and Mustafa call it rule by law as opposed to rule of law. Sometimes people call it lawfare. But this kind of somewhat manipulated, somewhat top-down imposition of law to punish, to persecute, that led me into the archives that I could find. So there's a good archive on Brazil in the Leuwenroth archive at Unicamp. It's photocopies of the roughly 700 cases in military justice that were appealed to the Supreme Court in Brazil during the dictatorship. And there's a similar archive in Santiago that the Vicaria de la Solidaridad put together. It's also lawyers' photocopies of cases in military justice in Chile. And they were created in similar ways, these archives. They were created by lawyers who were being sheltered by the Catholic Church and some other churches. They were trying to defend political prisoners. And then, of course, in Argentina, there was no archive. In Argentina, there was no archive because what records had existed had been destroyed, apparently, by the military dictatorship before it left office. And also, there were very few national security trials. In fact, the conventional wisdom is that they were, the trials in Argentina had all started before the coup of 76 that involved political prisoners and national security cases. So my answer to the question of why authoritarian legalism, why variation in authoritarian legalism, has to do with how military and judicial elites cooperate or don't cooperate in creating judiciaries that are amenable to, that are sort of acceptable to authoritarian rulers. So I argue that in Brazil, there had been this system of military justice that predated the coup. It involved a civilian judge and military personnel who sort of rotated in and out. And it was part of civilian justice because you could appeal to the STM and then to the Supreme Court. And that in Argentina, to take the most contrasting case, Chile being somewhere in the middle, in Argentina you'd have rupture, you'd have judicial attempts to punish political prisoners under the previous dictatorship that ended in 1973, and then that had been overturned, it had been rejected, all the political prisoners were released, and the military sort of got an idea that they couldn't trust judicial processes, that they were going to have to take the war on themselves. They were going to have to sort of enact justice with their own hands, if you like. That was the kind of feeling, I think, in 76 when the coup happened. So it's about the degree of kind of, and there's a nice phrase from a new book by Matthew Taylor called Decadent Developmentalism, and he talks about institutional complementarities. So my argument is that where there are institutional complementarities, where you get military officers and judges kind of figuring out ways to apply the law to dissidents and political opponents. And this usually starts prior to the creation of the military regime, but where you have some sort of consensus on that, those mechanisms can carry on and be used by authoritarians. But where you don't have them, it's more likely that the regime will go down an extrajudicial path.
And what explains variation in the degree of consensus and integration between the military and the judiciary?
I avoided using the term critical junctures in my book because I didn't want to wade into all of that that kind of philosophical, theoretical debate about whether, if you can really tell whether something's a critical juncture or not. But I do think that there are moments of crises when there's institutional fluidity. So, you know, sometimes political scientists talk about punctuated equilibrium. There's a shock to the system. You get a lot of reform, and then institutions sort of settle down and they become sticky and they don't change for a long period of time. I think you can see that with something like military justice in Brazil. So the hybrid system that I'm describing comes from the 1930s. You know, and that was a period of turbulence. The armed forces had kind of fallen apart in the 20s. Then you had the 1930 revolution. You had the 1934 constitution, and it comes out of that moment. where you, there's an integration of civilian and the armed forces and the civilian judiciary in the form of that, the, that way of constituting military justice with the civilian Supreme Court at the top. And that's pretty much the system. That's the system as it exists now. It wasn't changed that much. The only, all that the authoritarian rulers had to do in 65 with the Second Institutional Act is to say, okay, civilians charged with national security crimes will now go to military justice. So we'll put them there because we don't trust the civilian judiciary. Military justice will be able to handle it. They'll be able to understand the gravity of these national security issues. Put them there. And of course, that's the status quo until 1979, when that all the, that kind of exceptional legislation gets removed and you get you get civilians no longer subject to military justice under national security. You also get reform of national security laws as well. So I know I'm not answering your question incredibly concretely, but I think the idea here is that you have shocks to the system, you have periods of institutional fluidity, and then you get the creation of these kinds of mechanisms. In Chile, I think it also comes from the Alessandri period. There's a period of authoritarian rule in the late 1920s, where you get this this idea that military justice can be applied to civilians in times of emergency. And so the invocation of that in 73 by Pinochet is not unprecedented. That had been done several times previously in Chilean history, that the idea that the military could declare a state of emergency and could apply military justice to civilians had precedents that go back before 1973. So one of the things I noticed too is that regimes that come to power through coups, we tend to think of them as being very radical because they're taking this radical step of overthrowing elected leaders. But they're often not that radical in terms of what they do. They often use, you know, patterns, and they invoke ideas that are actually not that new. I think the regime, sadly, the regime that innovated the most of the three that I compared is the Argentine one, because they went on this kind of insane, they decided to engage in this insane dirty war, which they, you know, denied was happening when it was happening, and it bought them a little bit of time. You know, they didn't want to be condemned the way the Chileans had. They didn't want to have UN condemnations, and so they created this system of plausible deniability because people were being picked up by civilian, you know, people in civilian clothes with unmarked cars, and that bought them a bit of time for a couple of years. But then it became very obvious what they were doing. And unfortunately, you know, that was the most innovative regime, and it was the most murderous.
So if I understood your argument, it brings us to a paradox. On one hand, the more political repression gets judicialized, the less it gets violent. There's more space for lawyers to argue over the reach of national security laws, defend political freedoms, and literally save lives. On the other hand, the more political repression gets judicialized, the more it gets legitimized in the short run and institutionalized in the long run. So democracy may come back, a progressive constitution may be adopted, as it happened in Brazil, but those same national security laws that were conceived to suppress dissenters and the same jurisprudence that was produced by the courts, maybe to moderate, but in any event to implement those laws, they all stay in place, blocking further democratic development. Can you speak further to us about this paradox?
Yeah, that's an argument I ended up making in the book without having planned to do it. You know, this is one of the fun things about research, is you start out with what you think is probably going to be your argument, and then you end up discovering something that forces you to change the argument. And what happened was, I just didn't expect to encounter under democratic conditions these defenses of what had happened under the dictatorship. So I went to the Tribunal Superior Militar, or the STM, and I never got access to their records there. I always got those through the photocopies that were made for the, you know, and put in the Lunaroth archive. But I did look at their publications, and they have they have a publication called Revista do Superior Tribunal Militar. So they're kind of in-house journal. And there were articles written in the 80s and 90s in that journal about how well military justice had responded to the challenges of the 1960s and 70s. And I thought, well, you know, if you don't really know the topic, it sounds fine. But then you look at the record and you're talking about cases in which people were tortured. Their confessions that were extracted under torture were used to convict them. They were sent to prison for several years. You know, Nunca Mais shows that 25% of the defendants in these trials said in court that they had been tortured, you know, and that was dangerous to do. So we're assuming that a lot of people didn't say it, but they hadn't. So this is just really kind of appalling. But you get the defense of it because, as you say, there's a judicial record. It looks institutionalized. And the same thing on the Army side. I went to the headquarters of the Army in the Duque de Caxias Palace in Rio. And this was in the 90s. And I saw in their bookshop a book by Mario Pessoa called O Direito de Segurança Nacional, a book published in 1971 that was kind of defending all of the institutional acts and the way that the law was being applied under the dictatorship. And I thought, well, this is really odd that they're selling this book now in 1996. So I asked the guy, I said, could I buy one of those? And he said, oh, I've got to ask my commanding officer. And the commanding officer looked at me and probably thought, you know, this gringo's up to no good. No, sorry, you can't buy that. I eventually got a copy of the book. I got it at Harvard Law School. That's an example of both institutions, the Superior Court in Military Justice and the Army, kind of perpetuating a defense of what had happened under the dictatorship instead of doing what we kind of hope happens in democracy, where you reevaluate the past and you say, well, you know, that was excessive, that those institutional acts were a breach of Brazilian constitutional law. And, you know, democracy has to restore these ideas of limiting the executive and not allowing people to be prosecuted for crimes of opinion and so on and so on. So that's what made me notice that these elites kind of had a vested interest in perpetuating the defense of the past. And if you'd had a rupture, it's much, you know, so in Argentina, you don't have that kind of equivalent because the regime collapsed, the amnesty was thrown out, that past was condemned, and you were able to create more from a fresh start. And so I think the paradox that you're pointing to is really, it can be one that really hobbles democracies. I don't think it's insurmountable. I think you can chip away at that edifice. I mean, an example would be in Chile, where everyone said at the time of the transition, well, you know, because the amnesty has been upheld in Chile, there will be no transitional justice of any kind. You know, that's it. They've closed the books. And yet you got judges saying disappearance is a continuing crime. Disappearance is not something that's ended in the past. It's ongoing. Therefore, you can try people in court for disappearance. So you got a kind of loophole, if you like, a sort of fresh interpretation. And there's been some of that kind of innovation in Brazil as well, not on that issue, but on others. But I think it is a kind of sobering paradox because it means that something that can be a factor for self-limitation and the moderation of violence and the sort of, you know, break on repression that we could identify as a positive thing in a dictatorship becomes a kind of drag on reform in the democratic conditions, because you have actors that have a vested interest in upholding that past and saying that it was a worthwhile, you know, that it was a defensible past, if you like, and that it doesn't have to be critiqued and superseded.
I'm going to say something here that I don't know if it will take as a compliment or as an offense. I swear it's a compliment. I think your book is terribly underrated in studies of democratic backsliding. I don't see it being cited when scholars look, for example, at efforts taken by modern autocrats to pack courts and co-opt judicial elites so that they can rule unconstrained. And my hypothesis for this is that these scholars are trying to draw a quite sharp distinction between old days authoritarian turns and contemporary processes of democratic backsliding. And the assumption here is that in the former, the rule of law was completely eliminated, and in the latter, it is more subtly eroded. And I think that your book challenges this distinction in two fundamental ways. First, because you indicate that old days authoritarians also manipulated legal systems if they could. And second, because by the end of your book, you try to demonstrate that your framework also sheds light on political repression in democracies, with a specific mention to the United States War on Terror. I wonder if you could comment on these two things, and also on the benefits of comparing these undemocratic uses of law, not just across space, as many of us are doing now, but also over time. In other words, what can history teach us about this subject matter?
Yeah, that's a great question, Fabio. And I think you have a judicial background. So that how you think about these things in the law, in the legal area, might be different from my training, which is in comparative politics. But I do think it's true that in comparative politics, we spend a lot of time reifying regime type as the key to understanding political difference in the world. So, you know, how do we define democracy? How do we define non-democratic regimes? And then how do we measure those? How do we classify regimes? As if that is the kind of key fact about governments around the world. And if you know it's democratic or you know it's non-democratic, everything else follows. You know what civil-military relations will be like. You know what the legal system will be like. You know what human rights will be like. And I'm not saying that regime type isn't important, but regime type is not as important as we sometimes think, I think, in comparative politics. We sometimes assume that there are a whole set of variations that must apply simply because a regime is classified as democratic and not, or non-democratic. And if we think about democracy as a system, a kind of institutional, I'm trying to remember that phrase that Matthew Taylor came up with, I think he calls it institutional complementarities. You know, you have different sets of institutions that interlock. They can be very continuous across changes of regime, or they can be abruptly changed within a regime. So I think if you accept that, then you have to look at the whole regime type with some degree not skepticism, but some degree of capacity to disaggregate and look below the surface. And I think what you're saying is absolutely right. You can have democratic regimes that backslide, right, where you have a leader or a party that starts to reverse engineer democracy, you know, to sort of immobilize and shut down spaces that were previously very vibrant. So you're even seeing it right now in France and the UK. You know, both governments in France and the UK right now are trying to pass laws that make it more difficult to protest. And they're doing the reverse of what those defense lawyers, because in a way the kind of heroes of my book are these defense lawyers, small groups of lawyers who are often defending people without getting paid, and they're trying to create space within this system of authoritarian legality. So they're saying things like, well, of course, yes, my client was caught with subversive material, but he didn't distribute it. And the law says that, you know, the offense is to distribute, not just to have it, so you have to let him go. Creating spaces, and then saying, well, maybe you should not only change the interpretation of the law, but you should change the law, you should get rid of this particular law. So they're fighting to create space within these authoritarian systems. And then you have democratically elected leaders in a lot of democracies nowadays reverse engineering that process. So making judiciaries less independent, muzzling the press, making it more difficult to protest, giving police the power to detain and so on. So I do take your point as a compliment. Of course, it would be nice to be cited more, but it could be that the work is not cited as much because, as you say, people see these as two very different issues. The one, they see these old-time authoritarian regimes and what happened under them, and that's kind of a historical and theoretical interest, but it has nothing to do with contemporary backsliding. It has nothing to do with, say, what's happening in Poland and in Hungary and in Turkey and in India. But I would say, no, it does. It does. And I think what we can learn maybe as legal scholars, as political scientists, as historians, is how civil society can be effective in stopping that kind of movement. You know, what can be done even under conditions that look very daunting, where the state has a lot of power on its side, where it's able to, you know, sort of dominate institutions and pass legislation that's very repressive. Sometimes civil society can still find ways to resist and to prevent the very worst from happening. I mean, we're seeing this interesting drama right now in Burma, in Myanmar, where, you know, something that the military has done routinely over the last few decades is just stepped in and removed an elected government is really not being accepted, especially by young people, in a way that you haven't seen before. You know, so there's my colleague Ari Zoldberg used to call this, you know, when nothing changes, but everything changes, because people's mentality is different, right? There's no necessarily huge legal or institutional change, but people are not putting up with it, and the regime is having to deal with the consequences of that. So I'm really stimulated by the spirit of your question, which is, you know, why can't we open up our comparative lens a bit more to include all of these situations, not just the contemporary backsliding, but historic regimes that have been authoritarian, semi-authoritarian, whatever you'd want to call them, and then move in different directions. And that's another thing that struck me in that comparison, was that the whole arc of these regimes was different. I mean, Chile and Argentine regimes were kind of classic authoritarian regimes in that they came in with a huge bang and, you know, massive repression, with the idea that they would just kind of, you know, make civil society insensible, and then they kind of eased up. At least that's the pattern with Chile. Brazil was very different. Brazil was a fairly, you know, light touch coup in which the regime leaders kept interfering and kept closing things down and kept getting more repressive, even when they said that they didn't want to be more repressive, and they kind of slid into a much more authoritarian situation. So that's, I think, that dynamic is also something we need to understand better and explain. Because I don't think all of the backsliding, you know, we have these nice measures, we have all these indices, we have Economist Intelligence Unit, we have VDEM, we have Polity 4, we have Freedom House, we have the Gothenburg researchers. We probably have more indices on democracy than we've ever had before, and very sophisticated measures. But we don't necessarily know why these changes that are being monitored by these indices happen. And how, you know, we could push them in the other direction.
Okay, so this leads to a question that I wanted to ask you for years. You were the president of BRASA, the Brazilian Studies Association. You, until recently, directed a Brazil Studies Center. And much of the conventional wisdom in the field of Brazilian studies had been that Brazil had become a consolidated democracy and that democratic institutions were solid and functional. How did things deteriorate so quickly? What did Brazilianists miss in our analysis of the country? And what role do you think that we should have in supporting Brazilian democracy?
Oh, yeah. I hope to work with you on that. Try to keep it going. Well, let me take a step back and give you a little bit on sort of before we got to where we are now. One of the things that used to drive me crazy as a political scientist who was trained in the U.S., was the tendency, especially in the 1990s and the 2000s, in the political science community in Brazil, to import models from the U.S., especially on legislative executive relations, elections, things like that. And a lot of it was good work, but some of it would import the model without questioning the assumption. So, for example, the assumption in the U.S. political science literature is that a member of Congress always wants to get reelected. It's always about reelection, and everything they do is about getting reelected. Well, the Brazilian system was never like that. There are people who go to Congress, then they want to become mayor of their town, or they want to do something else. So you've got to question the applicability of those models. But there was also an assumption often in that literature, not always, but that the democratic system in the U.S. was the paradigmatic case, and that Brazil should aspire to be that kind of democracy. And as someone who had lived there, I always thought, that's a really bad assumption. Look at how it functions. Look at how the system functions. It's so bizarre in a way, the American system, compared to many other democracies, in terms of the way, for example, it translates votes into seats, you know, with especially when you get to the Electoral College, the degree of gerrymandering, the lack of competitiveness of most congressional elections, the very low turnouts, the huge amounts of money involved in the campaigns. Yeah. So, I mean, you live there, so you know all these things I'm saying. So I don't have to make that argument anymore. people have got that, I think, in Brazil, that's not really... they don't have to aspire to that. And that's not a model. In fact, that's a deeply divided, polarized, contested democracy. So I think that kind of distortion is gone. But what we have now is, as you're saying, we have now all these people saying, how did we get it so wrong? Why were we so complacent about Brazilian democracy when we got in 2018, a leader like Bolsonaro that don't seem to fit this model that we have of consensus and consolidation. And I agree with you. Consolidation is kind of a problematic word, because it sounds like, okay, you're there and then it's all over, you know. You don't have to do anything more. And of course, I think every generation has to fight to expand democracy to fit its own conceptions, and it's never over. And so the idea that something's consolidated is probably a misnomer. But it could be that as political scientists, we misinterpreted stability for kind of optimality. So if you look at, say, what Marcus Nobre calls PMDBismo, so the idea that there's this kind of big block in Congress that uses government for patronage purposes, basically, you know, uses government appointments and the federal budget to benefit itself, no matter who gets elected to president. And it's all about exchanges in Congress. We'll support your legislation if you give us, you know, this ministry, you give us that. Because that worked fairly well under Fernando Henrique and Lula, and was stable, and there was a big coalition, we assumed, okay, well, it's not only stable, it's quite optimal. It's good democracy. We kind of didn't look at the costs of those transactions, and we sort of forgot about what Paulo Sérgio Pinheiro likes to call social authoritarianism. So, you know, we had democratic institutions, we had a national human rights plan, we had formal equality of citizenship, but we still had people expressing these very offensive views, you know, that certain kinds of people shouldn't be using the airports and certain kinds of people shouldn't be buying new cars. And, you know, there was this kind of reactionary, traditional element in society that resented having any of its privileges encroached upon and didn't really want equality of citizenship. And I think, you know, right now we're in the middle of this first, what could be the only term of Bolsonaro. And I think we're all wondering, is this a blip? Is this some sort of, you know, fantastic exception that will then revert to the mean in 2022? Or are we going to have more governments of this type unleashing these kinds of social forces? And it's probably too early to tell about that. But I do think in some ways, as an academic, I feel like it's exciting, because we've gotten out of that complacency that we had in the 90s and the 2000s under that 16-year period. Because if you go from 95 to 2010, Brazilian politics almost becomes boring. I mean, it doesn't really become boring. It's not like Belgium or someplace, but you know, it's there's a consensus about a lot of stuff, and you're just arguing over, you know, and there's quite a bit of convergence between PSDB and PT. We're now past that. So it's interesting in terms of, you know, studying it, but it's dangerous in terms of what it could become. You know, and I think the evidence that access to arms has been going up, you know, more and more people registering handguns, lots of people on social media expressing quite extreme views. That's a bit frightening, you know, and that means there was an interview recently with someone, I can't remember the article, but a guy who opened a gun club in Rio saying, you know, I want to bring the US gun culture to Brazil. And I was saying, of all the things you'd want to bring to Brazil, why would you want to bring that? You know, I think I'm wandering off topic here, but I do think we're in an interesting phase, but also a challenging one, because I think I completely agree with this, the sort of underlying presumption of your question, which is that we didn't really understand. I think our analysis of democracy was flawed.
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, as I like to say, to open up your library and tell us, what are the three key readings that you would recommend to our project and audience?
So Fabio, now I'm going to reveal myself to be much less proficient in this literature than you. I'm sure you know a lot more than I do about good works in this area. And I'm going to cheat for the first one, because I'm going to give you a book that I contributed to. But I do like the Tom Ginsberg and Tamir Mustafa book on rule by law. And I'm biased because, you know, I learned a lot from that. That was one of these kind of closed conferences where everyone who was contributing was invited to present. And I learned a lot from the other people in that book. The other book I would mention, and this is actually a disappointment of mine that I haven't read as much as I would like on authoritarian legalism and this issue, because I think I would have liked to have been farther along since publishing my book in this area. But a book that I've really enjoyed teaching with, and that I think students have really opened up to, it's not really about authoritarian legality. It's more about the legacy of authoritarian legality and transitional justice. But that's a book by Martha Minow called Between Vengeance and Forgiveness, Facing History and After Genocide and Mass Violence. So she goes through trials, truth commissions, reparations, and history lessons. And it helped me publish something or write something that I published a few years ago on the Truth Commission in Brazil and why it came so late. Because it's a comparative, Martha Minow's book is comparative, and you can kind of see how exceptional Brazil is in the area of transitional justice, and not only in the kind of authoritarian regime it had. And I guess the third book I'd mention, and I cite this in a book, in an article I've got coming out in Journal of Latin American Studies on Samuel Huntington. So I have an article on Sam Huntington's role in liberalization of the Brazilian military regime. And it's by Rodrigo Pato Sá Mota. It's the universities and as Universidades e o Regime Militar. And I like this book because it opened up a new area for me. It's sort of complementary to what I was doing in my book. And it's all about how the universities were subject to a system of monitoring and control, some of it involving legal controls during the dictatorship. And it's a relevant book because I think, the Bolsonaro government isn't as competent, I don't think, as the military regime was. And so there's less real intervention going on. But I think that some of the same mentality about universities exists in the Bolsonaro government as it did exist in the military regime. In other words, they're hotbeds of subversion. Subversion and also promiscuous behavior, drug use, sexuality, and all that. And they have to be controlled. They're dangerous. You can see some real kind of continuity between some of the things that have been said by Bolsonaro government officials about universities and that. But those I wish I had a much more comprehensive list for you. But maybe we can talk about this going forward. I would like to work on this issue, maybe do an event together in the future.
That was Anthony Pereira. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Fabio.
If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions regarding the series or our project, feel free to contact me at fabio.desaiasilva@ou.edu.